Hello, welcome to Shelf Respect, the book podcast focused on both the craft and chaos of fiction. I'm Knox McCoy, and joining me as always, both of them trying to coax a young girl out of her house, it's Jamie Golden and Aaron Moon.
But for fun things, but for fun stuff. But
that's not my interpretation.
That's not how I saw it. Oh, yeah.
So in this episode series, Odd Reader Out, one or two of your Shelf Respect hosts will take a literary concept and the other host or hosts is unfamiliar with and an attempt to entice them into jumping on the bandwagon. Today, I am walking Aaron and Jamie through one of my favorite reading experiences, short stories.
But before we turn the page on this episode, did you know that Knox and Aaron are both published authors? They got real book deals and they published real arse books and they write on the regular at their Substack. So the books, Knox wrote The Wondering Years, How Pop Culture Helped Me Answer Life's Biggest Questions, and All Things Reconsidered, How Rethinking What We Know Helps Us Know What We Believe. I co-wrote that book with him because I wrote the foreword, and if you listen to it on audio, I actually did my foreword, which was so fun for me. When you look me up on Amazon, I have a book page. Okay, and then Aaron last year published I've Got Questions, Does every nonfiction have to have I've Got Questions, The Spiritual Practice of Having It Out with God. Now, you can check these out from your library. You can pick up a copy where books are sold. They're also the audio narrators of their books. Okay, so if you like listening to them here, wouldn't you love listening to them in long form for 7 hours straight? I think you would.
Do you know what's sad about my audiobook recording?
What?
Is that I recorded that the week, like 2 days after my grandmother's funeral and wow. 1 day after the election.
Wow.
I was in such a dark place.
The energy was low.
You can hear it. It's tough. It's
like,
a tough listen.
It's like Kate Kennedy's book, One in a Millennial, and she is like 8 months pregnant and them lungs working hard when you listen to her. Yeah. She's like, okay, and so like, when do we remember when we all went to limited two? You know, you're just like, her baby's on her lungs. Why can't she breathe?
The one I did for All Things Reconsidered, at one point a girl did the first one and a guy did the second one, and at one point he stopped and hit a button and his voice comes in the studio and he goes, hey, what are you rushing for? Because I tend to rush when I read, and it's just like breathless. It's like, and you're just like, freaking chill out. You're here for 2 days. What, like, the book's not even that long.
All right. So you can, the links to all their books will be in the show notes as well as to their Substacks. Knox's is Binge Thinking. Aaron's is The Swipe Up. They have thousands of subscribers. So you should become one of them as well.
Okay. I'm so excited. We're talking short stories. This is a dream come true. I can't wait to get into it. So we're going to talk very briefly about like the general idea of short stories. And then we're going to get into an actual, short story that
he
I thought
got
would
us
be
to
great.
Read an actual short
That's
story,
right.
you guys.
That's right. So, it is literally a short one. Some short stories are like actually long stories. So they're kind of liars, but this is a good short one. And I do want to respect what you put in the document, Jamie. It's where you... honestly, I read it so wrong. I was like, wait, do I have this wrong? Where are you going? Where have you been? By Joyce Carol Oates. In the rundown, it's basically like, what the f- and where the f- are you? And it's so disorienting.
Because you talked about it and then Aaron had written it down. And so after we got off camera, I went, okay, I'm going to do the show notes. Aaron, what was the name of it? And she said the correct name. And I went, okay, so sort of like this. And the, instead of just saying what she
where
said.
Where did you go and how did you get here?
Why are short stories named so weird? I don't know about that. That's not my fault.
So it's good. So we're going to get to that. Before we do that, though, like I said, let's kind of establish a little bit of baseline. But let's start with you two. On the show, in our conversations, you've both alluded to, I don't know if you said you don't like them, but you definitely avoid them. So, Aaron, like for you, is it a dislike or is it just like avoidance?
It's not a dislike because as I was like, I was looking back and I was like, what short stories have I read? Like, and I like most of the ones that I've read. Like, I love a good Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. I love an O. Henry. I love that Gift of the Magi.
Okay.
Give it to me.
Yeah.
I've read all of Flannery O'Connor's stuff. So I think part of it is, I was talking to Jamie about this, and I think part of it is like, I prefer investment. Not that you can't get invested in a short story, but I prefer TV over movies because I want more. I want the story. I want to get in bed with the characters, with the people, with the setting. And I want to just camp out there. And so I don't feel like you get that as much with a short story.
Definitely true. That's definitely true. Yeah.
And I feel like everything in a short story is so fraught. It's like, what is the meaning? What? Oh, there's this. And this keeps coming up. Is that? And then you look and you talk about it in your English class and they're like, that didn't mean anything. That was just like a thing. Like
that's a bad English teacher then. It all means something.
I know. He mentioned oranges and he just liked oranges.
Oranges always mean something. Knox taught me that.
That's true.
Death. Yes. They always mean death. Yeah. Yeah. No, but I think you're right. It's like the difference between going to a farmer's market and like a bespoke keychain, vegan keychain maker, or just go into Walmart.
Yeah.
Right? Like one, not to disparage like novels like they're Walmart, but they're doing different things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And your vibe might not be the one thing, and that's okay completely. Jamie, what about you? Is it dislike or just avoidance?
I think it's just avoidance. I've written, but I've never read like old school. I've never read Edgar Allan Poe. Like,
you didn't read Edgar Allan Poe in school?
No. And I've never read Flannery O'Connor.
If please God in heaven, let this go well. If this goes well, we're getting the Flannery next.
Okay,
because yeah. That is yeah. some good Fair stuff.
Enough. Yeah, that's some good stuff.
And I think for me, it's listen. I'm very much on record that plot is my whole heart, and I do find that short stories are idea focused rather than plot focused. A lot of times, maybe they don't always. Maybe as we'll learn today, they just are like, what do you think happened? How dare you? Okay. Which I don't mind in a vague ending, but it's like, well, I've only been here 10 minutes. Like, I'm not even invested yet. I don't feel invested. And so, like, with Aaron, I share some of that. But I also think that I do love a really immersive world. Mm. And I will say, with this short story that we read, I did feel like I could feel where we were. I could feel, so she did an excellent job. So that has been a reason, but this story countered that really, really well. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I'm just like, I want a rich setting and I want complex visuals and I want to, and sometimes a short story can feel thin in that arena. And so that is probably a testament to I've not been reading the right short stories. Or I'll just go, I want to be with Connie longer. What's Connie up to now? What's Connie's life like?
I don't know that Connie's...
Oh my God, if she's dead, I'm so mad!
Whatever it looks like, it's not wonderful. I'll tell you that. I will tell you that. Yeah. That I think that's true. A lot of times, it's what short story were you exposed to earliest? And if it's a sucky one, you're kind of like, I'm good with this, because you're right. It is such a different art form that I think that can kind of factor and function into your appreciation of it later on. Like for me in high school, I really truly did have a run, like four English teachers who changed my life. And one of them was a guy who actually just passed away, like I think a year ago. We all called him Yogi. And he spoke like someone who had done way too much acid at Woodstock.
Okay.
Truly.
Yeah.
But he was so wise and so excellent at interpretation. And so later on, I think as a senior, I was introduced to Raymond Carver. And when I was reading Raymond Carver, it was like a bomb went off in my head. And I remember reading him, like the first time we read Cathedral, one of the best short stories of all time. And I was so excited to talk about it. And I was like, I can't wait to read this or talk about this. And then I'm going to read everything Raymond Carver's been doing. And like, I can't wait to see what he's got next. And then Mr. Lambert was like, he died in 1988. He is dead. You will never get more Raymond Carver.
No.
And I felt like I was like, I missed something. Like I'd been born after something. And he's a master of the form. It's like this dirty realism. It's a very blue collar. It's very Spartan. If you have seen Birdman, the premise of the play they're putting on is a Raymond Carver short story.
Oh, that's cool.
So all his influence is in a lot of places. Will Ferrell did a movie. I don't remember the name of it. I don't think it's Where I'm Calling From. It kind of sounds like a Joyce Carol Oates a short story title, so I'm not going to mess it up. But it's been adapted a lot. It's very influential. So that's where I kind of got attached to short stories. And I think what I like most is a common misconception is that short stories just like a shrunken novel, and it's not. It's completely different, because the point of a short story is a different point of the novel, which is that investment, and it is that, like, let's play things out, let's see things evolve. With a short story, it's about constraint. It's about, it's 50 Shades of Grey, but for your brain, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is edging you, getting you somewhere, kind of torturous because you're trying to interpret what's this mean. But every word, every image, every idea has to earn its keep and function a certain way. Otherwise, it's superfluous. It is one of the oldest storytelling forms. It's oral tradition, fables, parables, all these are short stories. And I think really 1800s is when the short story really hits its apex, because you do have Edgar Allan Poe, you do have Nathaniel Hawthorne, you have Anton Chekhov. These were masters of the form and only inspired later generations. And I think what I like most about short stories is where it differs from an excerpt, because I think novel excerpts can be really powerful in terms of like, oh, I want to get invested in that story. It's the compression aspect of a short story. The compression, kind of like what you're talking about, Jamie, you kind of feel short-circuited because like, I just got here and now this is all resolved and over. But I think that kind of compression as a reading experience, it makes everything matter more, because you know this is only 12 pages or this is only 16 pages. So every page matters so intensely that you can't get lost. Like sometimes I'll be listening to audiobook, cleaning the garage, and I'll be like, what just happened? Who are we talking to?
Where are we?
Yeah.
We're in a bar? It's like the boundaries like are the editor almost.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. And that's why I think a Lauren Groff is such a fascinating example of, she's like, I could play right-handed and write you a big ass novel and you'll like it, or I can do left-handed and I can write you a little tiny shorty guy and you're going to love that too. And it's going to be completely hypnotizing. And I think that's what can happen, because like for this story today, I think it's a little over like 12,000 words. You probably read it 20 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm, Jamie probably read like four because you're a speed reader.
I didn't read it fast. And I was like, should I read this again? I don't know.
But it's like, but it's very small. And the meaning and the intent of it has been argued. It's 60 years old this year. And we continue to argue about what it means and what the interpretation is, which can be infuriating for some people. But for someone like me, I love that. I love that it's open to the conversation.
Listen, when you shared this book, Aaron and I immediately, because then we left the meeting, and Aaron and I was like, where is it? Where do we find it? And then we both try to Google it. She keeps repeating this one book that she thinks it's in. And I think you bought it too, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah, she like bought it. And I was like, but it says it's an Epic magazine, and like maybe there. And anyway, we've included a link in the show notes because it's in the U.S. archive and it's free and you can listen to it. You can read it for free.
But don't give any money to George Carol Oates's estate like I did.
Yeah, that's fair.
Or do.
Yeah. Or, you know, support her.
Now, she's still with us.
Oh, wow. Then never mind. No, then support women
she's
authors.
Like dead. Support dead women authors. Support living women authors.
No, she's
kicking around all the time. Like, she's George Carol Oates.
One of the most prolific authors in American literature history. Like, she averages two books a year, and she's been averaging like two books a year since the 60s.
Lord.
All she does is write. She's done like plays, novellas, poetry, nonfiction. She has something coming out, I think, next month or two. And she's like 158 years old.
I feel like Joyce Carol Oates, if she heard me talk about my creativity and writing going away, she would just slap me and be like, get your shit together. Just turn on the computer.
Just do it. Sit down and write.
When I feel like I get writer's block, she whispers in my ear and calls me the P word. And I'm like, you're right. You're right,
Joyce Carol Oates. Yes.
Yeah. But she's known for gothic stuff, very psychologically intense. I feel like today's story qualifies. I think she writes female vulnerability well. Hmm. And she also is able to bring in a sense of dread, and a specifically Americanized sense of dread. I think you can feel that in a Flannery O'Connor as well. This story specifically today was published in 1966. And I think it's considered her masterpiece short story. I haven't seen it in as many short story anthologies. I was at the used bookstore earlier this week trying to find it, and I couldn't find it as well. So I think that's a shame if so. It's really the peak of the form, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So did you guys have any anticipation of like, oh, I think I know what this is or what the vibe is?
No,
or did
I had
you do
no
any?
Idea.
Okay.
No, based on the title, I thought it was a road trip. When I opened it, I was like, this will be like on a road trip. Let me tell you what this isn't. A road trip.
Well, it is a road trip, just a bad one.
But it's not going to turn out great, you know?
That's right.
And in the beginning, you know, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is just pretty simple. this is like in my head.
Yeah.
And I'm talking one paragraph, two paragraphs in. And then I was like,
yeah.
Oh no, she's going to brutalize my soul with this. Yeah. With this story.
She is a little bit. Gosh. Yeah. And I think you pick up on that quickly because, and again, if you guys have, because the point was come in pretty clean.
Yeah.
And like, don't feel like you got to do a lot of heavy lifting. So interject if you have questions or thoughts or you've seen some stuff or had some observations. But this story itself is based on a serial killer from Arizona named Charles
Schmidt. I didn't know that. Aaron was like, yeah. There's a whole story about this guy being a real person.
Like a freaky serial killer. Like
yeah. Yeah.
A very unsettling.
They call him the Pied Piper of Tucson. Which, oh, as serial killer names go, is good stuff.
Because you never think the Pied Piper is going to live in Tucson.
No, you don't. You don't. Again, we're against Pied. Well, I don't know. Are we against Pied Pipers? We're against serial killers.
Yeah, I think we're against Pied Pipers. Pied Pipers are always bad, right? There's never a good Pied Piper.
I do think that's true. I think Pied Pipers, the whole thing is like, it was about leverage because a guy didn't get paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a European story. A guy didn't get paid by a city. So he's like, well, guess what? I'm going to take all your kids and kill them. And next time you'll pay. So we're against serial killing and Pied Piper.
My favorite thing is, I'm going to kill all your children and then I'll come back and work for you and you'll pay me next time.
Yeah.
And the ancient Europeans were like, yeah, okay, we will.
Yeah, okay. We will.
These kids.
We'll make some more. It's fine.
Yeah. We're not even sure if they're going to live very long. So the original title for this was Death and the Maiden, which is a literary trope, motif, kind of form of story. So she changed that, I think, at the last minute. Charles Schmidt obviously is a direct take on Charles Schmidt. And there's details about him that you'll see later in the story. And then at the beginning, I don't know if you noticed this, she dedicates it to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird. And it says To Epoch. That's a magazine that she's dedicating it to. But she dedicates because she wrote this while listening to It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which is one of Bob Dylan's songs about mortality, which is kind of what she's writing about. So so let's kind of transition into the close read of this story. After y'all read this, were you like, if you had to like put a summary or slug line or like a quick like 5-word thing on this, like what did you feel like it was about, Aaron?
The unsettling nature of being a woman.
Okay. Yeah, that tracks. That's about right. Jamie, what about you?
Yeah, like I, because one of the notes I wrote is must surrender to the misogyny. And like in the context of there's always a point in some woman's life, current and I think historically, that you have to surrender to misogyny. You have to surrender to cultural expectations of women. You have to surrender
for your safety,
for your contentment. Like you're not going to be content if you're constantly pushing against every restriction that has been placed on you. Mm-hmm. And so there's an ease with like, it's just easier to consent. Or to not fight the feeling, you know, of you're just gonna have to, and you see that with Connie. There she makes a decision, like almost consciously, to surrender to what is about to happen to her, whatever that might be, you know. And it's like it's part of that, and it because even at the beginning, like I was like, oh, I know her. And this is a 15-year-old in the 60s, but I was like, oh, I know her.
But like, it's so like there's all this like almost like she's pushing the boundaries of like her family, like the family rules, the family expectations. She's sneaking around a little bit, but it's all very innocent. Like it's not like there's nothing really wrong. Like we wouldn't like if as parents, we'd be like, you need to be where I told you to be. But there's all of this like. No. Like, it's probably fine. Like, probably in the 60s, it didn't matter that much, like, where they were or whatever. But it's, and then it just, like, it's like, you can't even, like, barely push against what is expected of you or how you're supposed to act without getting just absolutely pancaked by men.
Yeah.
Right. Generally. And you know what it reminded me of, too, is just a feeling I've had recently, because sometimes I can be a real a-hole on the roads. Like if I'm mad at you, like I can really, that's how I like manage my frustration of the situation is like, I'm going to cut you off. I'm not going to let you in. I'm going to maybe flip you off. I don't know, but I stopped doing that. Like after the pandemic, I stopped doing it. People were so angry. People were so mad. It now was an open carry, no permit state. And I was like, you just don't know when someone's going to snap. And I see enough of those TikTok videos and I'm like, somebody's going to snap and you're not going to be able to hold your, and I will get so mad sometimes when I see injustice about women, just like on a screen, not even in real life, but on a screen. And I'll just be like, I want it five. And it's like, well, you'll die. You'll die. And then I always think a man does not have to think like this. Yeah. Like they do not have to navigate the world they've never had to put their freaking keys between their fingers as they walk to their car in the parking lot. Like they don't have
Ashley
to.
Ashley and I were just talking about that of like, I was like, when I'm waiting on one of our daughters, I'll walk the parking lot, you know, if I've like got time just because I'm moving my legs. And she was like, and it's probably a safe place to walk too. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess it is. It never, never like, having to never worry about that. Right.
Yeah.
But she does in those terms. But this, reading this, again, I thought of the viral comparison of like, would you rather be stuck in the woods with a bear or a man?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This and reminded me of that.
You choose the bear.
Because this story puts the men in menace, you know?
Yeah.
Or the menace in men.
And it's one of the best, you know, there's lots of things that were commentary that was made about that. But the best one was like, you'll believe that there was a bear. You'll believe me when I tell you there was a bear. Yeah. You won't believe me when I tell you what the man did to me, you know?
Yeah.
Because the system doesn't believe me. And it's a weird thing because I've talked with friends because now obviously I'm 50 now and a lot of my friends are in their 40s and they're so cute. They're still because it's so embedded in us since we were little girls. Danger is always lurking. You are a prize to be won, a flower to be ruined, a piece of gum to be chewed, all the things, right? And it comes from all the places, school, church, home, all the places you are, Girl Scouts, like all the safety things. And then what happens is when you turn 40, you're useless to men now, right? Like you're not even
you're invisible.
You're actually invisible. And there's, let me be honest, there's a little bit of a comfort to that of like, oh, I don't have to deal with any of that anymore.
Like I was actually thinking about this the other day because I was walking somewhere and I was alone and there was a man. And normally like that would put me on guard. That dude didn't even see me. Like, I was like, honestly, this is preferable. Like, I don't.
It is. It's funny. Like, our friend Elizabeth, she was like, well, I have to be careful when I go, da da da. And I go, oh, girl, you've aged out of kidnapping. No one's stealing you. Yeah. But, like, I appreciate it. But, like, you're not bad. And it's hard. That's hard because then you're like, well, they don't even want to look at me.
The unhinged thing is you're like, what am I ugly now?
Because like, you've been told that the gaze is valuable. Like the gaze is what brings value to you as a woman.
And I think that's what this story does well is it's zooming way out thematically. It's about transition and duality, right? Mm-hmm. About occupying two different spaces. Connie is not a girl, not yet a woman, but she kind of is, but she kind of isn't. And I think that idea of having to contend with that of at the beginning, like she exists within a culture that prioritizes looks, right? Mm-hmm. But it also doesn't protect or prepare you for how to use that and how to be protected from that. So it's the duality of like sex, aesthetic attention or appeal can be wonderful. It can also be menacing, right? And that's exactly what you guys are talking about too, which is really interesting. In terms of Connie, let's talk about Connie for a second. As a character, she is described as a pretty 15-year-old girl. I think the age is interesting. She's described as having a habit of craning her neck to glance into mirrors. So she's vain, but she's also pretty, which is why she's looking in those mirrors. Her relationship with her mother is interesting because she thinks her mother's critical of her because her own good looks suck and she's old now, like you guys are talking about,
exactly.
Right? And she's jealous because being pretty is like everything. And so Connie is both physically appealing but also vain, which makes her vulnerable because the attentions of others is her currency in the world. When you guys were reading about Connie and you were taking in the description of her, Jamie, did you think George Carol Oates was being sympathetic to Connie or judgmental to Connie, the character?
Listen, in the beginning, it does feel very shallow. Like she's just pointing out all the shallowness of Connie. But there's a line when she's referencing, and it's early on, and that's when I knew, I'm like, oh no, there's a lot of sympathy here, because she says, because she's talking about Connie and her mother, and it says, but the two of them kept up a pretense of exasperation, a sense that they were tugging and struggling over something of little value to either of them.
Yeah.
That fight over who's pretty now and who's valuable. And it's like, it's not valuable to you at all. And that's the moment that I go, oh, this prettiness will not serve her, which is, to be honest, the case for a lot of women, especially as you, and that's a new concept to me as an aging woman, like, is someone in their 50s who is now aged out of the 18 to 49 demographic of value in the marketplace. The interesting thing too about that is that there are a lot of women who that has been their value the whole time. My value is obviously my sparkling personality, but, and beauty has never been my thing, that it's been like, am I pretty? Am I thin? I'm not classically any of those things. But as I watch women who had, it has been their thing for the majority of their adulthood, and then they enter this season of life where they are not fertile, they are truly, their whole insides are dying slowly from a lack of estrogen, they struggle the most. I think women like me go, well, I'm still fun when I'm on my drugs, like I'm still fun. But a lot of women who their whole value has been in their beauty, it is such a and so you see that in this mother of like, yeah, she was pretty. She's not anymore. And it's why we invest, you know, all the money in trying to stay pretty and trying to see, will this beef tallow make me stay pretty? And it will not, you know,
yeah.
It will not. Yeah.
Erin, what about you? Sympathetic or judgmental to Connie?
I think she is sympathetic. I think there's something to an older woman writing a younger character like this. That's just, it's inherently sympathetic, because this, whoever's writing this knows what the world is, and Connie doesn't yet. Connie doesn't understand that, like, life is not this, like, kind of fluffy, ethereal, like, everything's gonna go great because I'm cute. And you think that when you're a kid, and you're like, I have all, like, everything's gonna be just fine because I have all the tools I need in my toolbox. But Joyce Carol Oates, she knows, like, she's the all-knowing narrator, and she actually knows that, hey, none of that is going to save you, none of that is going to protect you in this world. It actually puts a target on your back,
because the whole world is Arnold.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, and I think it's she's not doing this. She's not trying to, or even interested in the masculine aspect of this. But I think in a modern sense, this is why you see the ballad of the high school athlete who was like, who's still talking about it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, when your personality is a thing and the shelf life is short or even longer, when that shelf life is over, there's a difficulty. If you've not been balanced, there's a difficulty with reconciling with who are you now and what do you offer the world, which I think is captured really well in the mom. I think to the character of June, the sister.
Oh, such an interesting, like, because the mom wants, he's like, why can't you be more like June? Why can't you be? And she's like, June's so ugly. I hate June. Like,
but June is safe.
But June is safe.
Yeah.
June is safe. And I think it's a great insight into the comparison aspect of that women are subjected to. Just always being like, this should be better.
Yeah.
But I think it's also a distillation of women can be something to look at, or women can be a function. It's not quite the Madonna horror thing, but it's not that far away from it. Of just like, what is, there's a simplicity to function, but a complexity to expectation that we have of women.
Like a shut up and sing kind of a vibe. It's like, we don't need you to do anything other than the thing we want you to do.
That's right. Let's talk about Arnold Friends. The ickiest but most interesting character in this story. He's really the disgusting evil straw that stirs the drink. He is obviously a deeply sinister character. He is, I'm not going to call him a teenage boy because he's pretty clearly a man, that shows up in a really creepy way at first with Connie. And then he shows up to her house, to abduct her. He's first seen outside a drive-in restaurant where he immediately tells her, gonna get you, baby. Ugh. And again, in your first foray into short stories, that could feel like a throwaway. That matters.
It's not.
That's a very important.
No, I knew. I knew enough. I've been making content with you long enough to go, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Something's awry. He is going to come back.
I think we'll that means something specific. Yeah. So, Aaron, when you were reading about Arnold Friend, what was like one detailed description, any little aspect that made him the most disturbing to you?
The thing that was so disturbing to me was the way she described his like physicality and his wardrobe. The like is he wearing a wig? Is he wearing makeup? Why is he walking like he has socks in his shoes? Like what? And I was just like, what is this? This is so, why is he dressed like a scarecrow? Why is he doing that? And then I realized, or when I went to like do some research, that, you know, you mentioned that this was based on a serial killer, Charles Schmidt, who did the same thing. Like he would like put smashed Coke cans in his boot to be taller. And then he told everyone that the reason he walked like that wasn't because of Coke cans, but because he got into a fight with the mafia, which is like so insane.
Strange.
And he like drew a mole on his face and all this, like all this wild stuff. So I thought that was so, and it's also obviously deeply metaphorical, like, you know, dressing up in the, like trying to look a certain way in order to get a certain thing, in order to make Connie feel safe. But really, you look like a freaking predator, man. Like you did not do this right. You are so deeply unsettling. Oh my gosh. I hated it. I hated it.
Yeah, the particular way that it's like, it leads off with the wig. So you're immediately like, wait, huh?
Yeah.
But there's slowly, the description is pulled apart. Like you start to see the lines around his face. That's the legs. It's the slow deconstruction of, this is not a teenage boy.
No.
Who, I don't know if you guys saw, I think it's, I don't remember the name of the movie, but there was an adaptation of this story into a movie.
Oh, Smooth Talker.
There you go, Smooth Talker. Laura Dern and Treat Williams. Laura Dern looks very young. She's obviously very young in this. And Treat Williams is a great casting because he presents like a classic 60s, you know, teenager. But as you watch him go, he's Treat Williams, so he's older. And it feels older. So, Jamie, what for you, when you were seeing the description, stood out the most?
Well, at first, because I had no context for this at all. Like, I did truly go in blind and then didn't read anything else. So, as I was reading that description of the weird things, I thought, he's an alien.
Okay.
Like, I was like, I just didn't know where this was going to go. Like,
you're not incorrect, though. I mean, in a sense.
He is an alien to this community, to her, like, all the things, because of her saying, you know, I've never seen you. I don't know you, you know, and you're just rooting for her so desperately to be like, you got to go get a gun, girl. You got to get a gun. But I think the most interesting detail in the story, and the one that I would not leave, is not Arnold, but Ellie.
Oh, Ellie.
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because Ellie was like, and especially in the look back after finishing it and going, oh, Elliot is the compliant observer.
That's
who
right.
Who is, and we know all of those people. Like we see those, there's this trend on TikTok where, you know, there's this universal symbol that if you touch someone on their arm, and then you look back and you are making a symbol with your hand that it means I'm in distress. And it's supposed to be a way for you, for a woman, to make a hand gesture so that someone can know you're in real danger with whoever you're with. Okay. And so they'll make these videos where this couple will pretend that this is happening to them. And they'll just kind of film it from across the street to see, will anyone see her gesture and stop? And it is, and it could be the way they've edited it as well. But consistently, because a lot of times it's just people think she's bumped into them and they're just like, oh, what? And, you know, some people get mad because they're like, watch where you're walking. But then some people are confused, like they don't know what's happening. But let me tell you, every woman goes back and is like, goes up to the woman, hugs her like they know her. Like, hey, girl, oh my gosh, it's been so long. And you see it over and over again. And you're like, that's right. Those are not Ellie's. Those are people that know. You know, that, if you're willing to do this and take this risk, then you must be in real danger. And they'll like take, and it's so funny because this couple is acting, but they always are like, no, I'm taking her. We're going to go hang out and have coffee. Stay there. You know,
what's the gesture? Because I don't know what the gesture is.
I'm doing it on the camera. It's like this. It's like, your thumb inside your palm and your fingers extended.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, if someone did that to me, I would just be like, that was weird.
And no, of course. And that's why they're trying to educate people on like, if you see this, this is a secret way. I mean, mainly it was coming out of like, Wayfair may have trafficked them. And so you have to help this lady. But Ellie is, one, I didn't like the name Ellie. Like, yeah. I didn't like that because it made me uncomfortable. Just not even about like gendered names or anything. I was like, I don't like that. Is it Elliot? What's your deal? I don't like it. And then what's your, and Elliot is just like, or Elliot is just like, I'm here for, to listen to the music.
And I'm going to cut your telephone.
That's right. And I'm just going to put up with whatever Arnold is doing because of however it benefits me.
Yeah.
And I just, and you don't know. You don't know any of those real theory of like, is he getting to be a part of the killing, the raping, the whatever? And it's just a weird, you're just like, ah, there's always somebody like that in the life of somebody awful, you know?
Well, and I think that goes back to the duality aspect of, I think when you see a sketchy person show up with another person, you're like, okay, well, this can't be that bad because there's another person here. And then that quickly turns into, yeah. Oh, crap, this is real bad.
Now I'm because, two against one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ellie's a grown man. He is a man. Yeah. We don't know that at first, but he's revealed to be a grown man who is just listening to music and threatening to do bad things. Yeah. So this is bad.
Also, can I ask a question? What? Why is his name written on the side of his car? And why is there writing all over his car? It may, like, that also was so weird and unsettling.
It's not a good crime, man.
No, it's not. Like, right? And that, yeah. I was like, is that the point of, like, it just doesn't matter. Like, who gives a shit? He's going to do it anyway with his name on his car. He's going to kidnap her with his name on his car.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the car. The car is so interesting to me because it is, if you're not a car person, a jalopy. Do you know what this kind of car is? Do you know what it means?
I think it's of like the Beverly Hillbillies when I think of a jalopy.
I think of a car that's like pieced together. Like it's all the parts are pieced together.
Meaning it's kind of old and broken down. Right.
Yeah.
Which is metaphor for Arnold. He is an older guy. The jalopy is painted gold. So he's an older guy trying to appear younger, right? Trying to appear appealing. So I think that's so interesting, but it also is his personality because you mentioned he's got a couple things on it.
His name, and then there's a dent in it, and it's circled, and it says done by a crazy woman driver or something.
Right, so a dent, woman driver, a previous run-in, there's menace there. There's a saying, man the flying saucers, and I was like, I don't understand what that means. That's just, that is trying to appear youthful, because that's something the kids said like a year ago.
Oh, that's right, because she's like, we don't even say that anymore.
But, right. So it's like, hello, like fellow youths.
6'7".
It's like Steve Buscemi. Hi, youth. Yes. Hey, youth. That's
exactly right. But the name is really interesting. You guys might have seen this if you research a little bit. Joyce Carol Oates has talked about this. She wants you to take the R out of both. And when you do that, it turns Arnold Friend into an old fiend.
Oh.
Because he is a stand-in for a devilish figure, right? Wow. A demonic kind of figure. But the numbers is really interesting, right? Because there's she hasn't really spoken on what they mean exactly. But there's a variety of ways that you can interpret it. One where if you see numbers, it's always good to add them up. And do you know what those
Taylor
numbers
Swift
add
taught
up?
Me that.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. So add those up real quick and see if you can figure out what that number is. And it rhymes with 69 because it's 69. So, which feels like a very youthful thing to do, just to be like, nice, you know?
Yeah. Nice,
like,
nice.
That's a funny guy. Like, if you play church softball, there's always one weirdo who gets number 69.
And you're like, bro.
Which is always insane to me.
No.
It's like, this is Baptist League church softball.
What are you doing? Yeah.
So that's one interpretation. One is it's his age plus the ages of his victims. So he's 33, 19, 17. Now he's working on 15. Okay, they're getting younger. Epstein vibes. There's a different interpretation, which is the most interesting of all to me. And it is that this is a Bible verse. Okay?
Okay.
So if you go to Judges 19, 17, and Judges is chosen, you're like, well, what's the 33? If you count Old Testament backwards, the 33rd book is Judges.
Okay.
So when you get to that verse, it says, when he looked and saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, where are you going? Where did you come from? Obviously she's saying something.
What?
Now, what's this story about? This is about a Levite from Ephraim who goes to Bethlehem to retrieve his concubine.
Is that story.
Okay, yeah, this is a very Sodom and Gomorrah-ish story. They stop overnight. Where they stop, men of the city surround the house, and they want to rape the male traveler. And the Levite's like, that's not going to be me. I'm sorry, concubine. This is going to be you.
Yeah.
So she steps out of the home and is abused all night. And then the next morning, the Levite finds her dead, and he cuts her body into 12 pieces and sends one piece to each of the tribes of Israel as a way to like, hey, we need to get revenge for what just happened here. So
even though I definitely did it.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't think it was going to be like that.
I'm the Ellie of the story.
Golly.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So the point of this story in the Bible is to show like all of the social, cultural, religious chaos, the depravity, the lawlessness going on then. Obviously, if you want to transpose that onto this story, there's a conversation of that happening here as well. And that's all messaged on the car, the vehicle that he drives
that is
in a really
fascinating.
Interesting way.
It's so interesting, too, because like in similar to Taylor Swift, who has to pack so much into a song, right? Into a very short 3-minute song. You have to, and any songwriter who's wanting to do more than just, you know, Single Ladies, which who's to say Single Ladies doesn't have an immense amount of symbolism.
Of course.
But you have to pack all these moments and these phrases that are need to mean multiple things, right? Like you're trying to gain so much meaning from it. And it's interesting in a short story because in a book, you might throw in an Easter egg here or there or something that's self-referential for yourself or someone you love or whatever, but you may not be packing enormous amounts of meaning. Like there's 7 different things that those numbers can mean. And it's one line in a very short story, literally. And so I'm fascinated by that of like, how if you're a good short story writer, you know, like you have to pack the punch of a novel, a full length novel into these, you know, 12,000 words.
And I think the best short story writers, those details, there's a quantum aspect to them.
Yes.
Of like they can be a variety of things.
Sure.
They can just be the number 69. They can be the Bible verse. They can be the ages of him and the victims. They can be all those things at once. They can be none of them. They can be one of them. Like the feet in the boot. It can be like the serial killer, or some people interpret that to mean their hooves. That's why he has a difficult time walking because he's the devil incarnate, you know? So that's the fun part of short stories is like you can kind of pick choose your own adventure.
How fun for Joyce to be like, well, I didn't even think of that. That's a good one. Like to be on the Reddit thread, the Joyce Carol Oates Reddit thread.
Oh, that's a good point.
I love that. I should have done that. That was smart.
What does 69 mean, guys? Yeah. I didn't even know. Okay, let's talk the setting and the imagery. We'll talk about that for a quick second. And I don't know if anything like jumped out to you guys the most or like an image that you're like, what's that about? Obviously, we have, I think the diner is an important image because it's one of the first places she goes where she's not supposed to go there. They cross a very dangerous highway, read into that. Mm-hmm. And when they go there, I was really interested. I wrote down the, or I underlined the description of it, her and her friend. They went up through the maze of parked and cruising cars to the bright-lit, fly-infested restaurant, their faces pleased and expectant as if they were entering a sacred building that loomed out of the night to give them what haven, what blessing they yearned for. And then blah, blah, blah. The music was always in the background, like music at a church service. It was something to depend on. A lot of rich ideas there of this diner being a sacred place. I don't know if you guys noticed it. Fly infested is used 3 times.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I was like, what's up with the flies?
Because she's dead. Dead body has flies.
Oh, could maybe be foreshadowing of that for sure.
I don't know.
There is something like something rotten is happening here.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I think a cursory reading of this is like, oh, Connie kind of sucks and she's vain and she kind of deserves what she gets. I don't think that's what's being said here at all. I think it's the culture sucks. The culture is rotten. Her father is described. I think her father and the friend's father 3 times are described as never bothering with
they don't care
what their daughters are up to, right? And it's this idea of like we bring these girls into this world and we influence them and we tell them how they should be and then we're never bothered enough to make sure they can function safely and confidently in the world, which is really interesting. Music is very important. I don't know if that's imagery as much as you constantly are hearing of music, and that's a great indicator of the duality of the duality theme, because Connie loves music. It soothes her. She's always playing the music. We also see Ellie playing the music in a more foreboding way. But I think music is used as an inroad for Arnold to get to her, because I think they talk about Billy King.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And so they connect about that. And if you notice, as they continue talking, the way he talks to her is described as like sing-songy.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like melodic. So
it's a way of kind of hypnotizing. Yeah. And then to me, the most important and the most interesting imagery is the doorway. That's one of those, it's duality, inside, outside. But it's also transition. It's girl, woman. And for the second half of the story, that's where Connie is the whole time. She's in that doorway. Because I think it is on the heels of, you know, watching Sinners and watching the Oscars. Sinners, a movie predicated on you got to invite the vampire in, right? Which is really interesting. In this one, she's got to be invited out to him. That's a whole premise.
Him keep saying that he was not going to come in the house unless she touched the phone. I kept thinking, is he an alien? Is he a vampire? I'm always trying to jump ahead in my head, going like, let me see if I can puzzle this out. And I never can. I'm the ideal reader. Like, I'm always going to be surprised. But I was like, wait, why? Why does he need permission? Like, why does he require that? Is that to make her feel safe? Or is that his own standard? Like, does he have suddenly a standard in his killing, raping, pillaging, whatever the thing is? Is this a standard that he has? Because he's like, well, I am a gentleman.
Or like, I don't want to get my evidence all over the house.
Maybe so.
True.
See, Aaron is a true crime fan. So that's where that comes from.
Well, and I think symbolically it's interesting, that idea of duality again. Connie hates her house. She doesn't like her family around it. There's
she doesn't
always
want to be there.
Tension. Right. Now it's the place where she feels protected and safe. Mm-hmm. And once she comes out of it, she's in trouble. And even right before she does come out, she describes it as like, she doesn't remember how, like, it looks different now. It needs a curtain. She never noticed that before. And I think that's a really interesting way to use this thing that formerly she resented, now she wishes she could go back to, which obviously that's something so many of us feel as we grow up. Like, we wish for the simplicity of childhood, you know, and the carelessness. So at the end, obviously, she walks out the door. She crosses the doorway. Did you guys interpret that as a surrender? Or was this like Joyce Carol Oates giving Connie something like resembling a kind of agency in this?
I viewed it as surrender.
Yeah, I viewed it as surrender. Yeah,
that it was just like, you can fight this, or you can fall asleep softly in the snow.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, like, you can just succumb to it. And because what will the fight get you? More pain? Because you're going to have pain either way. So why not have the least amount of pain that you possibly could have? Mm. Even though we're taught from an early age, do not go to a second location.
Yeah.
Do not go to a second location under any circumstances. But it's also like, to what end? Like, she's 15. She doesn't have the experience or the knowledge or the warnings.
She's not been listening to a lifetime of true crime podcast.
That's exactly right.
She has no idea
she doesn't know about Dateline.
No.
You know? And so you know that you're just like, I know enough to know, because I was looking while we were chatting, because again, I did not know this was a real serial killer. And I was like, when were serial killers the worst? And it's because I grew up in the land of serial killers, like, and kidnappings and all the things. And it was 1987 was the 212 known serial killers in the U.S. at the time. But it said it all started in the late 60s. Like, that's when it started picking up.
Well, have you read, there's a little bit of evidence that like some of the boom in serial killing is due to in the Pacific Northwest, like chemicals gone awry.
Really?
And it not being regulated and it getting into the water supply.
What?
That might be completely tinfoil hat, but that's an interesting thing.
Okay, I will be researching
that. That is interesting.
What about you, Aaron? Is it agency or surrender?
It was surrender for me. And I will say it was so frustrating because I was like, wait, but no, like, don't do what you're about to do. It was so, and then I thought, like, what else is she, like, she has no other option here. She doesn't realize that she has other options. She doesn't realize that he's walking on Coke cans. And so she could probably lock the door and get to the phone in time. Like, she probably could. And it makes me feel about, like, the final girl kind of a thing of like, it's the, you know, the stupid girl, she gets killed first, and it's always the hot girl with the big boobs or whatever. And so I it was so frustrating to me because she obviously senses the danger. She obviously knows that she doesn't need to go with him. And then she just
does. And you're like, no, don't do it. No.
Do you think, is there an aspect to her choice that because Arnold demonstrates some kind of supernaturality of like, I know where they're at. I know their names.
Yeah,
I know what they're doing right now.
I'm looking at them.
Yeah. Is there some aspect where she's like, okay, this is something
I can't
beyond
control. Yeah.
That I have to give? Because I think it's so interesting that both of you talked about at the beginning the plight of women of just like, you want to fight against this, but you also have to comply with it mm-hmm. at a certain, and that's kind of what the ending is.
Yeah.
It's compliance, it's, reluctant compliance.
It's like someone makes a misogynistic joke, like in a room full of powerful people and you're the mm-hmm. only woman. And it's like, well, you can look like a bitch
yeah.
and say yeah. something, or you can just be like, oh, yeah, women.
Oh, because it's the U.S. hockey team. Right?
Oh, 100%.
You know, I think all those guys are really bad humans? No. Do I think they're not? Do I think some of them are Ellies? Yeah. Probably at least one of them, because statistically one of them is an Arnold.
Yeah.
You know, and it's difficult because it's like the same thing. Real danger, and it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, but particularly for women, real danger doesn't have clear expectations. We don't know the other side. That's why we assume the yeah. worst. Whereas I think sometimes men go, well, what's the word? Are we going to fight? We physically, like, yeah. we throw down? We do a little weapons yeah. or fist? Whereas women's are like, well, I could get, the bear could kill me, but the man could do so much worse.
Yeah.
To me, than the bear could do. And you yeah. just immediately go there and you're like, well, I would rather just die. I would rather die than do
yeah.
what else could happen to me. Yeah.
Because there's an interesting read on it being a sacrificial choice of like, I'm going to do this so my family doesn't die. Because he kind of does.
Yeah,
like,
he does kind of say
if you don't,
that.
I will do this. And there's on the second to last page, I underlined a line and it was talking about her green blouse. And it was like her green blouse was like she had noticed that her green blouse was wet. There's a variety of ways to read that.
Yeah.
I read it as baptism, like a new kind of understanding, a baptism of understanding of like, this is what I have to do now. And I think that kind of plays into that last paragraph, the last line where he says, my sweet little blue-eyed girl, he said in a half-sung sigh, again, the singing, that had nothing to do with her brown eyes, but was taken up just the same by the vast sunlit reaches of the land behind him and on all sides of him. So much land that Connie had never seen before and did not recognize except to know she was going to it. So it's that plight of women. You got to do this. You don't really recognize and you don't want to do it, but you got to do it regardless. And I think the idea that he's saying, my sweet little blue-eyed girl, when she has brown eyes, it doesn't matter about her.
Oh,
it's not about yeah. her, a woman, a person. It's just women in general. This is kind of what we do to them. It doesn't really matter the specifics.
Con, I thought her blouse was just wet. And she just noticed it.
I couldn't
figure
that out.
That's so impressive that, again.
I don't know that that's the interpretation.
No, I know. But like me, I was just like, it's raining. Is that what make it worse?
Yeah.
It'll be hard to find the evidence, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
So let's go. We'll do a couple superlatives here, or a couple categories, I guess, here at the end. We'll call this one the cold take. Aaron, what was your just initial reaction to the story? Like, don't feel like you got to analyze it, but what was something that really jumped out or resonated with you the most?
Are all short stories, do they all have a premise to make you feel existential dread? Like, is that the thing?
It is.
I haven't read like a happy one yet.
Yeah, it's. I don't want to.
Little sads. Little sads.
It's a feature and a bug. You know what I mean?
I think like it just has. I was so taken by the tone of this book. Like it immediately starts off, and I don't know if this is just because like I've read some short stories, and so like I get the existential dread vibe. But like you start off, and it's like, something really unsettling is about to happen. And it's just, it just kind of like wavers on the edge of that sword of like, nothing's wrong, but everything is wrong. It just, the way that it felt was so unsettling.
You're right. And I think it does, they do tend to function unencumbered by, well, we met this character at the beginning, so probably something happy will, maybe it'll be different, but it will be happy. No, we don't play by those rules over here.
It's very immediate res, like you just kind of get thrown into a story. And so I don't know, like the creepiness, the unsettled, like just disturbing. It felt disturbing. Like there was something underneath it that you're like, oh, that shouldn't be there. but I can't get it out. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. And we're stuck with it
and we're
now,
stuck
unfortunately.
With it.
Yeah. Jamie, what about you? What something has stood out or resonated?
The beginning is so good because I feel like she packs so much into describing the family that you immediately know who you are. She sets a place up. So, and again, as someone who likes to be immersed, I felt immediately immersed. Mm-hmm. Like I know what the dining room table is like in this house, even though I didn't live in the 60s, but I know exactly what the table setup looks like or feels like from like, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the family in A Christmas Story. I'm like, they're sitting around a room like that. Like he's focused on the wrong thing. The sibling rivalry, like all of it feels very grounded very quickly, which is at first you're like, oh yeah, I'm in a place and these things are happening. And then like Aaron said, you're going to ruin your life with the story and these people that you've just met. And now they're dead. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think what I really liked was the ambivalent fathers. Kind of talked about it a little bit. All the dads just don't care.
Girl dads
just taking them where they want to go, not asking any questions.
Yeah, just letting them live.
Yeah.
What a benevolent guy.
Like even the talk about church and religion is interesting because it's easy to read it as judgment of like, because I think it's a never bother with church.
Yeah.
And you know, choosing a diner as like a place of sacred worship instead of an actual church. I don't think it's that. I think it's more, it almost kind of feels like a little bit of a passive swipe at religion for especially in the mid 60s for being a little feckless and being open to being supplanted by cultural institutions, you know, like the diner or even cultural art like pop music. But I think what I like is Arnold Friend, as disgusting and evil as he is, he is the rationale for why Connie is taken in because in the difference between her father, he pays really close attention. He is focused and fixated on her in a way that can be appealing. It can be nice. And I think it's really interesting that when he drives up and she hears the car, do you remember what she says? She says, Christ, Christ, twice. So it's like, this is a kind of, it's not the God she wanted, but the God of attention is something we're introduced to very early to her that is a priority.
And she's worried about immediately, she doesn't even know who that is. She's immediately worried about how she looks.
Yeah. She's not worried who could this person be. It's, I forget the mention, but it's like how she looks, how her hair is drying is the important part. Jamie, a foggy moment for you. So like something in the story that and maybe we've already talked about it, but if I think this is a hallmark of short stories where you read something, you're like, what's going on here? What was that for you?
Listen, it's they're shopping and she's self-reflecting, and it's where she says everything about her or describing her. Everything about her has two sides to it. One for home, one for anywhere that was not home. Her walk that could be childlike and bobbing or languid enough to make anyone think she was hearing music in her head. Her mouth, which was pale and smirking most of the time, but bright and pink on these evenings out. Her laugh, which was cynical and drawling at home. Ha ha, very funny, but high-pitched and nervous anywhere else, like the jingling of the charms on her bracelet. I love that because I was like, uh-oh. Like, that's the moment I knew. It's like, oh.
She's not a girl, not yet a woman.
Right.
Yeah.
And that
duality again.
But duality in a different way. Like, we're all putting, for people who mask, like, there's a version of you that some people get, and there's a version of, and I always lament that because it's like, there shouldn't be two versions of you. There should be one version of you that everybody gets. And if they don't like it, that's their loss. But even at 15, learning that lesson so early, because so many women, and I do think there are men who struggle with that, but like there's so many women who go, oh, I don't get to be as profane as I'd like to be, or I don't get to be as bold or ambitious, or because I have to be one I mean, we have this dear friend that always said, I'm not this version of myself on the internet because I can't monetize it. And I think about a lot of women on the internet right now who are one version on camera or on mic, or there's a version of them that makes money, and then there is a version of them that is real. And it's not that version of them that's on mic isn't real, but like there's a lot of influencers. I just think about the trad wives. Those trad wives are some of the most ambitious women on the planet, but they deny that ambition by being like, no, I'm here to care for my family.
These are my farm-raised eggs.
These are my farm-raised eggs and my raw milk, and I care about my family. It's like women, I saw a video today where a woman was like, I just believe in a family vote. I believe a husband and a wife should have one vote, and the husband should decide. And I went, you're saying that on a mic without your husband there. Like, how do you not see the duality of that? And so that's what I felt very connected to in that story of her already knowing I cannot be both these people.
I've got to cultivate two different senses of self, 100%. And what about you, the foggy moment that
I was just really confused about the flies. Jamie has this really beautiful like breakdown of the duality. No, I thought it was lovely. It was so good. But I was like, why are all these flies showing up? Because again, I feel like it's like it all means something. But we talked about it and that makes perfect sense. That like something's rotten here. That's also not hard, Aaron. You should think more.
No, we're different. We don't have an English degree. He's better than us.
Well, no, it's just like what? Why are they here? And it might be more complicated than that.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that.
But that's the fun. It's like, is this a really complicated thing?
Yeah, and maybe that's why we don't like short stories, because we're just like, well, she's dead, and that's the end of that, and that didn't make me feel good, so I'm not going to read any more of those. You know, instead of going, ooh, what's the deeper story here? What are we trying to say? Like, that helps.
I think the first time through. The foggy moment was the car for me. I was just like, what is happening here? What's going on? What does this mean? Because it clearly means something.
Yeah.
So it was good to kind of be able to look into that. Okay. Lastly, Aaron, what was the WTF aspect? Something you read that you're just like, what was there on here?
Okay. Well, I know we kind of talked about this, but like, why was she wet? Like, I don't understand why she was wet. Did she get stabbed? Like, what happened? It feels like all of a sudden she's just like, I'm wet and I have to do this now. And I don't know. And I was like, I don't
know. She was being baptized.
Right. Well, I know. And I know that.
No, he doesn't know. But I
was still just like, what the hell? Like, I didn't.
Yeah.
It just felt like it came out of nowhere for me of like, all of a sudden she's wet and I don't know why. Yeah.
I mean, there's a variety of interpretations.
Yes.
Some are not fun to think about, and I don't think are valid. There's, it could be sweat. It could be tension. It could be, but I think it's without naming the reason, the mechanism of why the wetness, I think it the only way you can really read it, I don't know. The only way I'm reading it is some kind of baptism of clarity.
I mean, I think that's smart. I like that.
Yeah.
I just was very confused.
Yeah.
It is confusing. It is, because it stands out and you're like, hey, what's going on here and why? Yeah. Jamie, what about you? The WTF aspect.
Okay. So it's a moment when he turns to Ellie and he's like, he's telling him, you know, you're deaf, you need a hearing aid. But then he goes, don't hem in on me. Don't hog. Don't crush. Don't bird dog. Don't trail me. Don't crawl under my fence. Don't squeeze in my chipmunk hole. Don't sniff my glue. Suck my popsicle. Keep your own greasy fingers on yourself. And I was like, okay, but what? And she says in the middle of that, he's saying in a rapid, meaningless voice, as if he were running through all the expressions he'd learned, but was no longer sure which one of them was in style, then rushing on to new ones, making them up with his eyes closed. But it felt like he was having a dissociative moment, or he was like
an alien.
Well, part of me, like literally what I thought was, I was like, oh, are Ellie and he also in a relationship? Like they are also in a romantic relationship. But he also needs this. Like and Ellie understands it and is consenting to it. But it's like, he's like, shut up, Ellie. Like,
you're ruining my vibe.
You're ruining my vibe. You're not being a good wingman. And don't crawl under my fence. Don't squeeze in my chipmunk hole. It's very WTF.
What's worse, that or don't suck at my popsicle? Because that's a wild thing to tell your bro. Well, that's when I
was like, okay, are they together? Like, and then this is just a side. This is like, this is their... This is the way they show each other affection, is by murdering people.
See, I kind of read that as kind of what she says, which is like cycling through. And it's almost like a Rolodex of phrases the youth say.
Yeah.
You know, and just like, let's see here. Get in my chipmunk hole. I think the kids said that.
Yeah, but he's doing it so fast and rapidly. Yeah. It's almost like he's having a mental health.
Like a manic.
Like it's a manic episode. Which I actually didn't like. Like, and immediately I was like, no, don't let this be the water in the Pacific Northwest to excuse what has happened. Don't.
Yeah.
But I do think there is an interesting, element to we excuse the behavior of men. The Brock, what was his name? Brock Miller? Chanel Miller and Brock.
Turner?
Turner, thank you. Brock, yeah. Turner, the rapist who raped
Promising kid.
Promising kid. Judge, yeah, says he's a promising kid. We don't want to ruin his life because he raped a girl behind a dumpster. God forbid. Yeah. And there's a part of you that's just like, are we giving this guy an excuse suddenly by having him have this little mental health breakdown in the middle of this? Yeah. And I was like, don't do it. You're responsible for your actions, yeah, even if you're in it. Yeah.
So the only one I had was when he was able to see and know things he shouldn't see and know. I was just like, what is this? What are we dealing with here? You know, and I don't mind that it's left into the, like, let the mystery be, and we don't really know. I think it plays into the atmospheric aspect of the story, but that was the thing that stood out. I was like, I don't understand this at all. What's going on?
Yeah.
So, okay, that's gonna do it for our conversation on this odd reader out on.
Hope you like fear and ambiguity.
Yeah.
Existential dread.
if you liked this short story, I would recommend, I'll give you some other short story recommendations. I mentioned Cathedral by Raymond Carver. That's a great one. A Good Man is Hard to Find by Flannery O'Connor. Very similar vibes.
Yeah, I was about to say, I feel like they were sisters.
Yes, very much. And then another one with a little bit of increasing dread, one of my favorites of all time, Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. It's one of the best of the form. I would check that out as well.
You know what? Yeah. As I started thinking about it, I was like, oh wait, I've read short stories. And
oh yeah.
But like, I've read novellas, but those are different, right? Those are
long, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Little
but bit. I was like, yeah, oh, but you know when Stephen King, but you know why I love Misery? They made it into a big long movie. Or The Body, they made it into a big long movie called Stand By Me. So I like them when they become big and long.
Yeah. Or I think The Apt Pupil is a Stephen King short story that they turned into a movie. It's really, really good. So that's going to do it for this episode of Shelf Respect.
Okay, don't forget, everything we talked about is in the show notes, and we would love to see you talk about it too. Share your favorite short stories or collections in the comments on this episode post on Patreon to help folks build their TBR.
Ask your pointed questions, declare your intentions, or start a respectful fight in the comments with one of your enemies just to eventually become lovers.
I'm Jamie Golden. You can find me on the internet at Jamie B. Golden.
I'm Erin Moon. You can find me on the interwebs at Erin H. Moon.
I'm Nox McCoy. You can find me on socials at Nox McCoy. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
The end.